Anybody?
We're working on San Diego, but let's begin.
Okay. So tonight I want to welcome Professor Hal Varian from Berkeley School of Information Management Sciences.
That's good. Management's enough.
All right. Who's an economist, and he's going to talk to us about a great deal of thinking that economists have done over the last 5 years or so about computer security kinds of issues. And I'm not going to eat into his time anymore, but I do want to thank him for coming. Professor Hal Varian.
Thank you. Well, I'm not really sure if I can live up to that billing of a great deal of thinking, but I'll give you some thinking on economics and computer security. And in particular, what I'm going to talk about is some general principles of liability, how that interacts with insurance markets, a little bit about efficiency and coordination costs, and a little bit about some implications of this weakest link technology that people talk about all the time. So, to dive right in, let's say a word or two about liability in general, and then we'll talk about how it might apply to computer security. So what's the role of liability? Well, the idea is that you might have some accident, which might happen, and the probability of that accident happening could depend on effort that various people put in to try and avoid that accident or reduce its cost. And the question, the issue arises because the costs that are borne if the accident occurs may be different or not directly related to the impact of the effort that people take in trying to avoid that accident. So right now you can think of an automobile. At this level of generality, it could be an automobile accident. It could be a security intrusion by a computer. It could be a terrorist incident, whatever. And what you try to do, ideally, and the assigning of liability is to get the incentives right. That is, you want to set up incentives so that the parties invest an appropriate amount of effort in reducing the expected cost of the accident. So liability has to do with who pays and how much the accident occurs, and ideally you want to try to set the incentives so as to reduce the expected cost. Now, it's important to understand that this doesn't have anything much to do with compensation paid by a perpetrator to a victim if some accident occurs, but it's really much more about the cost that people face if the accident occurs. So think about, for example, traffic violations. If you do something that's deemed to be dangerous, like going 90 miles an hour in a 30-mile-an-hour area, then if you're caught, you pay a fine, and that fine doesn't necessarily go to victims of accidents. There's a whole other set of rules that relate to that issue. So it's really about who faces the cost of their actions and how much. This is a very involved area, but I just want to mention two very simple basic principles. One is what's called the least cost avoider principle. And that's a special case, but nevertheless an interesting case. It says in certain situations you might want to assign liability to the party that's best positioned to reduce the expected cost. So here's an accident waiting to happen, and I can do some things to try to avoid that accident. You can do some things to try to avoid the accident. So we look at who has the least cost of avoiding the accident, of affecting the probability that the accident occurs, and the liability is assigned to that person. I emphasize, special case, but it's an interesting special case in this context. And then the second principle is a more general principle, and that holds.
Sorry, yes. Is least cost analogous to greatest ease in some way?
Yes, absolutely. And I'll make this clear. I'm going to enlarge on these points in the next slide. So this is just an introductory slide. We'll make it clear in the next slide.
So we have last clear chance for automobile accidents. It doesn't say anything about financial cost. It's just, hey, you had the last chance to avoid it, so it's your problem.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So the second issue is the due care standard. And the idea there is that some authority, courts or regulatory body, sets a due care standard. And if you meet that due care standard, then you're off the hook. But if you don't meet that due care standard, you have to pay some cost if the action occurs. Okay? So there's two different principles, least cost avoider, due care standard, and I'm going to give you a very, very simple little model of each one. So here's the least cost avoider, and if you look at your screen, you should see some big yellow plus signs that are replaced the minus signs that were there. That's just my typo correction technology. The model is person one can take some effort, person two can take some effort. There's a cost to person one per unit of effort taken. There's a cost to person two per unit of effort taken. The effort influences the probability. More effort that's taken, the lower the probability the action will occur. And in this particular special case, we've said that the probability the action occurs depends on the sum of the efforts. That's, again, a special case. So that's the model. It's a very simple model. What we want to do from society's point of view is we want to minimize the total cost, the cost of taking the effort plus the expected cost of the accident occurred. So that's the goal. And how do you align that with the individual incentives? Well, if you think about it, what you want to do here is you want to make the guy with the lowest cost exert all the effort. So, you know, I mean, the proof is mathematically trivial, but just differentiate with respect to E1 and differentiate with respect to E2. And if you think about it, you want the guy with the lowest effort cost to put all the effort in. And so you assign all the liability to him. The cost of the accident are borne by the person who has the lowest cost. So that's this idea of the least cost avoider. So notice that there's a little bit of a free rider problem here. If one party exerts all the effort, then the other party has all the costs paid for of the accident, so he says, I'm not going to put any effort in at all. But that's okay in this case, because the assumption is that there's a very large cost for one party and a very small cost for the other party, and you want to assign the liability to the side that has the lowest cost. So it's a fairly special case, but it's interesting in the context of security. I'll explain why in a moment. But before I do that, I want to talk about the other case. This case, the due care standard. This is much more general. You write down the same thing, only now the efforts of the two different agents, the two different parties in the accident, could enter the probability anyway. You know, not just as a sum, but in a general function. And then what you want to do is you want to find the efforts that minimize the expected costs. You set the due care standards to be equal to that effort level. There's no liability if you meet the due care standard. Otherwise, you pay a fine equal to the cost of the accident if the accident occurs. And you could show that that general principle of setting a due care standard and then letting people make choices in light of that standard works in a great variety of cases. Now, there's a whole bunch, much larger literature on this. What happens if they share the cost of the accident? What happens if there's a defense of contributory negligence? I mean, there's a whole big literature on variations in liability rules and how they affect incentives and what is it that works in different circumstances. But for the purposes of this talk, I only want to mention these two different possibilities. Okay? And how they work out in practice. This is about all the theory that we're going to have. I want to talk about what the practical implications are in the rest of the discussion. Okay? So maybe before I do that, I should see if there are any particular questions or obscurities that I've uttered that need correction now. Okay. So, sometimes this effort cost of the different parties is so extreme that all the liability might sensibly be assigned to one party. So imagine somebody writes a closed source computer program that has egregious bugs in it that allow zombies to take over your PC. That's one user, that's one of the parties, and the other parties is my grandmother in Florida. Well, my grandmother in Florida doesn't know how to do anything to prevent zombies from taking over a PC, doesn't know what a firewall is, doesn't know anything, and it would be kind of unreasonable to think that she should bear a lot of the costs of this security incursion, because she can hardly do anything to avoid those costs. On the other hand, the person that's creating this program might know a lot about how to do it, and you want to assign liability in a way that they put the effort into trying to avoid the security incident occurring. So it's a plausible situation where there's extreme asymmetry between the parties. One party has a lot of technical knowledge, is well positioned to try to avoid the accident or incident, and the other party has very little that they can do. Okay? So that's the case where you might want to have all the liability assigned to the least cost avoider. But other situations, when the parties are more symmetrically placed, you might want to have a due care standard. So suppose that the situation now is you've got the creator of the program on one side, and you've got a sysadmin on the other side who has some level of knowledge and expertise about security. And then you might well say that the right way to deal with that kind of liability problem is to put a certain due care standard on the creator of the program and a certain due care standard on the sysadmin. So, for example, it might be a situation where there are patches that are issued for this program, and the patches should be applied in a timely manner. And if the patches are applied in a timely manner, then there's no particular liability born for the incident. And if the program is created following certain practices or expectations and patches are issued at appropriate intervals, then there might not be any liability for the other party. So obviously putting that into practice requires a lot more. It's easier said than done, but the way things work out in reality is that the due care standards end up being determined by the courts, and typically they will apply industry practices. So what does it mean to execute due care in the creation of this particular product? And they'll try to look for standards or practices that are used in the industry, and of course they can evolve over time. So I think that this is, first of all, a very important role for the security community, because if people could agree on standard practices, then I believe that those practices would eventually be incorporated into the tort law, and you would begin to see the emergence of a better liability system for computer security issues. And I would also emphasize that if the security community does nothing and leaves this all up to the courts to decide what the due care standard should be, then you're letting yourself in for a lot of trouble, because the courts are not well positioned to make important technological decisions about what standards of security are important. And one question would be, should you try to institutionalize this kind of determination of due care standards? So as you know, there's FASB, which is the Federal Accounting Standards Board, which sets accounting standards for companies, and companies are expected to adhere to these standards. And one could imagine there being a standard-setting body like that, either set up as an industry consortium or a private body, or potentially as a government body. But the construction of those due care standards is a critical part of setting reasonable liability law, and in my opinion, we should start thinking about those issues.
Now, presumably, yes. Presumably in the 60s or whenever, the auto industry vehemently opposed safety standards. Is that right?
Yes.
And so we expect the software industry to do the same thing regarding liability for software vulnerabilities?
Well, I think that what happened is the automobile industry opposed safety standards in part because they thought that people weren't willing to pay for safety. So there was an issue where the automobile industry said, people want horsepower, people want speed. If we invest a lot of money in safety rather than horsepower, we're going to lose our market. And so part of the question is, nowadays, you look at automobile companies, and some of them at least, will advertise on the basis of safety. So same thing with computer security, I think. There is a demand out there for more secure systems or more reliable systems. And the issue is how much people will be willing to pay to have those systems. Well, let me give you an explicit
question, which you may get to, but is there a role of liability in I guess there is, in encouraging companies to invest more. Alternatively, if a company argues that it's moving forward as fast as it possibly can, is that an argument against the imposition of liability?
So if you could argue that you were doing as much as was humanly possible, in terms of, we go back and look at this, these little models, then you'd say, well, increasing my effort would not affect the probability that the action occurs. You know, more effort, more money, more time, more speed doesn't have any impact. So in that case, there's no, if that's true, there's no useful role in increasing the effort beyond that point. So in that particular case, I would say if you argued that you're doing the most you possibly could, then there'd be no role for additional liability at that particular time.
Here's what causes me to ask that. There's a guy at Microsoft now named Scott Charney who used to run the cyber crimes unit for the Department of Justice. And when he was in justice, he was, Mr. There Should Be Consequential Liability. And now that he's at Microsoft, he says, hey, the jerks are turning as fast as they can. There's no reason for consequential liability. But it sounds like there's an actual economic argument for that position, in addition to the usual lawyer's ability to change sides.
There's a question of, is it ever really the case that you're doing the most that you can? But I think it could be that there are security measures that are so onerous from the viewpoint of either the builders of the systems or the users of the systems that you wouldn't want to do it. This is what somebody told me about the Orange Book. They said it's easy to get a computer to meet the Pentagon standards, just disconnect it from all networks, take out all storage devices, and boot up, and there you are. So, that would obviously, that might be a secure system, but it wouldn't be a very useful system. All right, so let me mention this very nice paper that many of you might know, Why Crypto Systems Fail, by Ross Anderson. This is a paper that got me interested in this topic in the first place. And Ross is a computer security researcher at Cambridge, and he was hired as an expert witness by a bunch of people who had a dispute with the banks about ATM usage. So the banks would charge them for ATM withdrawals, and they said, I never made this ATM withdrawal. So you read this paper, there are a lot of testimony and a lot of people that said, you claimed I made this withdrawal, but I can prove I was 20 miles away and couldn't possibly have done it, and the banks said, no. So what happens is he looked into this issue, and what he found out was that the banks in the UK had managed to maintain the position that their systems were fail-proof. And the courts had adopted this view. They said, no, if there's a dispute between you and the bank is right unless the individual can prove him wrong. And in the US, we actually have the different assignment of costs here. You're right unless your bank can prove you wrong. So now what are the consequences of these two different assignments of costs or assignments of liability? Well, what happens is U.S. banks invest in risk reduction technology. So what do? They put a camera at the ATM machine. They make sure there are two people in the room when the money is counted or loaded into the machine. There's an auditing system. People sign off. It's the usual sort of stuff that you use when you're trying to track money. You're careful. You're careful. Why? Because you bear the cost if something goes wrong. And you want to make sure that you have evidence to back up your view. And the bank was well positioned to invest in those risk reduction technologies. But in England, in England, they didn't. You could document all sorts of incidents where there were typically not cameras in the ATM machines. One individual could load the machine. There were people signing off as the money moved from place to place. It was basically pretty sloppy. So the problem was, why was it sloppy in England and not sloppy in the U.S.? Well, it's because of the parties who bore the cost. The user is not in a very good position to manage the risk in that case, where the bank is in a very good position to manage the risk. And in a sensible assignment of liability, you want the bank to have the onus of bearing the cost if the dispute occurs. And the individual has to establish that an individual doesn't have to prove that he was right, he just is the sort of default choice. Now you could say, well, there's problems on that side too, because, you know, obviously there's possibility of fraud in the individual, but in this particular case, I think it's much like the model I mentioned earlier of the least cost avoider, where the bank's the least cost avoider, so they should bear most of the liability. And if you think about it, there are lots of cases like this. In the United States, when credit cards were first issued, I don't know if anybody in the audience can remember this, but what happened is the bank would actually send you credit cards in the mail, valid credit cards. You didn't have to authorize their use, and they would be unsolicited. They'd arrive in your mailbox. You remember this? Yeah, it's amazing. And so what happened is thieves would then break into people's mailboxes, steal the cards. They would go out and charge up money on the cards, and the bank would send you a bill for their actions. Well, obviously, this was ridiculous because the individual didn't really have a good, easy, low-cost way to avoid this risk. You could say, well, they should have put in concrete mailboxes or something. That would be one way. But really, it was a situation where the liability in that particular case, because of a ruling by the Federal Reserve Board, was on the banks. Okay, so the individual was liable for the first $50 of transactions. After that, the bank bore all the liability, as long as the individual notified the bank that his card was stolen within a certain number of days, etc., etc. So as soon as that liability was assigned to the banks, what do you know? They stopped sending out unsolicited cards. They started putting risk management tactics in place. You had to call up and authorize your card. You had to do this. You had to do that. And, of course, the liability was constructed so that the individual did have to meet a due care standard, maybe put a little quotes around that, but a kind of a due care standard. They had to notify the bank if the card was stolen within a certain number of days. And it's the same sort of thing with phone cards and so on. In fact, what's interesting about it is once you get those standards in place for credit cards, when debit cards came along and check cards, there is no minimal liability. If somebody steals your debit card and they look over your shoulder while you're punching in your PIN number, they can run up charges on that card and you could be liable for them in terms of the regulations. But banks, in order to encourage the use of debit cards, have in fact come out and said, we know we'd rather have you use a debit card than a credit card, so we'll give you the same liability limit on your debit card as you currently face on your credit card. It's a lower cost technology for them, debit card processing as opposed to credit card processing. They want to encourage debit card use, so in fact they have voluntarily, in many cases, accepted the same liability that's in the regulations for the credit card use. Okay, so there's a role of competition here. If you kind of assign the liability in way, get a base level of liability right, then you can let people compete, and they'll have to do at least as well as that in order to get their technology adopted. I think that's also an interesting lesson from this little bit of financial history. Now, liability sounds like it solves all the problems, right? No, there's other issues. One issue is the role of insurance. And if you think about, again, how economic institutions work at a kind of a general level, we've got two big ways to manage risk in our society. One is insurance markets, and the other is the stock market. And one of the questions that you have to ask before you dive into this role of trying to understand how insurance affects incentives when you have this liability framework, first of all, you have to ask this question, well, why are businesses buying insurance in the first place, particularly if it's a publicly held business? Because after all, the individuals can always manage risk by diversification. So here's a big bank. The big bank has some probability of getting hit by some security incident. And if you have several different banks and it's kind of random who gets hit, the individuals can, in fact, purchase a portfolio of banks, not just hold one bank, and spread that risk of the security incursion across their portfolio. So one of the things you really have to face is, well, why is it that companies are buying insurance if their stockholders can self-insure by diversification? Okay. Well, what's the answer? The answer is insurance companies don't just provide insurance. They provide risk management. So they help you, in many cases, reduce risk. So here we are, actually, University of California does self-insure, I believe, for most of the buildings. But if you're in a private building, there's probably a sprinkler system. And you look at it, and the sprinkler system might be every 6 feet or every 12 feet. There's a certain standard that they meet. Now, in this particular case, at this time, that standard is probably set by your local building authorities. But you could imagine a situation where the insurance company would say, okay, if you have sprinklers every 6 feet, we'll insure you at this rate. But if you have sprinklers every 20 feet, we'll insure you at another rate. And if you don't have any sprinklers at all, we'll give you an even higher rate. Or you could imagine a life insurance policy that says, if you're a smoker, here's your life insurance rate. If you're a non-smoker, here's a different rate. And what's kind of nice about those is, of course, you don't have to go around and verify whether they're a smoker or a non-smoker when they sign up. You only have to verify if they're a smoker or a non-smoker when you have to pay the life insurance. So it's not a case of huge verification costs ex ante. You only have to do the verification ex post, and the same thing with the sprinkler systems. So how does the insurance company come up with this risk management? Well, they're really well positioned to do it. They've got all those records of what happened to the probability of the damages if a given event occurs, and they can recommend actions which will help reduce the probability that that event occurs or reduce the cost in the case that the event does occur. And they can require compliance, because you don't get paid unless you actually comply with the conditions under which the contract were issued. And they can also disseminate best practices, because by putting these requirements in place and only paying you if you meet the standards that were imposed, that's a way of doing things like institutionalizing what the regulations are with respect to the sprinkler systems. So there's this story, I don't know if it's true, but it's claimed that in China you only paid the doctor while you were well, and if you got sick, you didn't have to pay him. And so he had good incentives to keep you well. Well, you think about the insurance company, it's the same sort of thing. You're going to an insurance company, you're saying, how can I minimize the cost of an accident? And the insurance company says, do A, B, and C. And if the insurance company screws up, they have to pay, right? They pay when the accident occurs. So if you think about this from the viewpoint of computer security, and you think about the liability discussions, which I had earlier, the role of the insurance industry is not so much to provide you with pure insurance, that is, you get paid something if the event occurs, but rather the role of the insurance company is to help you do risk management, to try to take practices and put policies in place to minimize the costs that are incurred if the bad event occurs. So ideally, and I want to emphasize ideally, the role of the insurance companies in computer security business would be to try to identify practices that would help reduce the cost of computer security and issue insurance policies contingent on the adoption of those practices. So, for example, you can look at things like the good old Y2K problem, where there are various companies that certified this was Y2K compliant or this was not Y2K compliant, and then if you were Y2K compliant, you could potentially get better insurance against various suits that might be brought. You could imagine these kinds of due care standards that I was talking about earlier being imposed not only by a liability system, but potentially by an insurance provider. So they would say, if you want insurance for us against costs associated with a computer attack, you must install cert patches within 2 weeks of their being issued, or some other standard like that, some other standard which would be an appropriate weighing of the costs and benefits of engaging in that particular accident. They wouldn't bother to insure you at all unless you passed certain security tests. I don't know if Satan is still around, but that would be the kind of thing where just like you might not be able to get life insurance until you passed your physical exam. And so my belief is that if the cost of insurance, the cost of computer security are as high as many people seem to think, you would expect to see insurance companies move into this area and attempt to try to determine what the appropriate practices are for risk management in computer security industry.
Questions from San Diego?
Yes.
So we actually do some work with an insurance carrier who actually issues cybersecurity policies. And while they do attempt to use controls like those that you list here, the big problem that they have versus normal first or third party liability policies is that in those cases there are real actuarial data that relate the controls to the probability of payout. And in the computer security case, there is a big problem because there is a possibility of large-scale correlated failure. Generally speaking, insurance doesn't need to deal with an adversary that works on enormous scale. That's why you have, in case of war, exemptions. In the computer security case, they're really running scared. What happens when the next, super worm comes out and knocks out all of their, all of the people have policies with them?
Mm-hmm. So the question then is correlated risk, and I would have to say that although this is a real problem, I recognize that it's true. First of all, when the fire insurance business was immature, people didn't have good actuarial data about fires either. It takes time for the actuarial data to accrue, and you would think that it's no harder to do it in this area than in other areas. The point about the adversaries, I think, is very well taken. But the point about the correlated risk, well, if you look at it, we have earthquake insurance in California, believe it or not, and it's very highly correlated. If you look at Los Angeles, there are many, many institutions that have earthquake insurance. If an earthquake hits, it would be billions of dollars worth of damage, and yet it manages to function. So I don't think the correlation is necessarily so strong as it is for some other events, just like fire, floods, think of New Orleans. They're very, very correlated events there, but the insurance market can still function in those events. Why shouldn't it be able to function if a super worm comes out? Believe me, the damage that was done in New Orleans was much, much larger than the damage that would be done by most kinds of security attacks against individual users.
So the claim there is that most people will not have flood insurance and therefore won't be compensated. But what you're saying is for some price they could have purchased it. Is that right?
Yeah, the question is, of course, what happens is it may be that the risks, it could be a situation that they have such an overestimate, the insurance companies have such an overestimate of the cost of risk, and the industry is not competitive enough that you really don't get these policies issued. I don't think that's the problem. Insurance companies would like to make money. But the issue is the one that was mentioned a few minutes ago, that right now they have only a rather vague idea of what the cost of those policies would be, and they might have an even vaguer idea about what the practices are that would mitigate that risk. Right? So this comes back to this question of professional standards for security, which play a role then not only in the liability assignment, but also in the insurance industry willingness to insure. Because if they could say with some confidence that if you do X, Y, and Z, the probability you'll have a serious attack is such and such, then they're in the same position as they are with fire insurance or accident insurance or flood insurance.
So question for you, Doug.
Yep.
Won't there be a much greater push to move into the insurance markets once there is some sort of assignment of liability?
Absolutely. Absolutely, and in fact, what happens is, let's say that more generally, once there's an assignment of liability, then it's much clearer who bears the cost, and there will be all sorts of ways to try to manage risk, just as in the credit card example. When it became clear that the credit card issues bore the liability for the mischievous use of these cards, then they undertook the appropriate measures. So as soon as you assign the liability, you want to do the risk management, but the point I'm making here is that the insurance companies will then have a role to play in terms of helping to manage those risks. Because fundamentally, it's not about being compensated if the bad event occurs. Fundamentally, the issue is managing risk. And so you want somebody who has good incentives to help you manage risk. Well, who's that? That's the guy who has to pay you if the bad event occurs. Okay?
Would there be a second tier of problems here, though, in that the reinsurance industry would look at the first insurers to underwrite these policies and say, well, gee, 90% of the world's laptops or desktop systems are inherently insecure. So why should you, as an insurer, take on that enormous burden?
Right. Well, it may well be that the insurance would be too expensive for my grandmother to want to buy. So it's, again, it's this issue that if the cost is putting in an entirely new system that's hardened against various kinds of attack and is very inconvenient to use, yeah, might not be much of a market there. But that reflects the actual cost. I mean, if I really would rather subject myself to the chance of getting a virus rather than taking the appropriate actions, well, that's going to do it. And you can make houses completely fire resistant or completely earthquake proof, whatever, but the cost would be so prohibitive that you wouldn't want to do it. Okay, let me go on because I'm running out of time here. By the way, you're absolutely right that there's not only is there a secondary problem, but there's a tertiary problem. It goes on. And I want to talk a little bit about some of the other problems with insurance. So in economics, there are two big problems with insurance markets. One is what we call moral hazard. And the problem there is if you're fully insured, you don't have any incentives to take care. So if you're absolutely fully insured, you may as well... Now, why should you bother to try to reduce your risk? In fact, I have to tell you a story. There are two old guys in Florida are sitting on a bench, and one says, how did you come to be here? And he said, well, I had a warehouse in Cleveland, but one day it burnt down, and so I decided I didn't want to rebuild. I was too old. I just took the money and retired to Florida. And the second guy says, gosh, it's almost the same story for me. I had a warehouse in Detroit, and one day a tornado came along and blew it down. I collected the insurance, but I decided it was too big a cost to rebuild, so I just retired to Florida. And the first guy said, boy, that's interesting. How do you set a tornado? So you get the point that if the insurance is too good, people aren't going to take sufficient care in trying to avoid the bad event. And so in general, if you try to look at the optimal insurance policy, you want people to bear some cost if the bad event occurs. And it's the same thing with respect to computer assurance, that you want to give them an incentive to engage in risk reduction measurements as well. So typically it's not going to be full liability, the kind of type I mentioned in the first case, but it's going to be more like the due care liability where the individual doesn't, the insurance company doesn't want the individual to be fully insured because he wants to make sure that they take some actions to try to reduce the risk that they face.
So there's a restaurant here in Seattle that burned down about 15 years ago, and they were very slow to rebuild, and the reason turned out to be that they had business interruption insurance.
Ah, well, there you go. It keeps you slow. So you see the problem. This is obviously not necessarily a social problem. It's a problem with the insurance company trying to figure out what these contracts should look like, but typically they aren't going to involve full risk avoidance, obviously. Second problem, which is much worse in terms of society, is what we call adverse selection. So adverse selection has to do with this. The people who are in the riskiest position are going to want to buy it. So if you look at the pool of people that purchase insurance, they're going to face a higher risk than the people who don't purchase insurance, typically. So if you offer bicycle theft insurance, you might look across the country as a whole and see, well, there's a 1% chance of your bicycle being stolen. But you know what? If you go to a college campus, maybe there's a 5% chance of your bicycle being stolen. So if you set the rates to reflect the population as a whole, it won't necessarily reflect the risk borne by the people who actually choose to purchase the insurance. And that can actually destroy markets. So imagine, for example, things like genetic testing. So if you have this gene, some bad thing will happen to you when you turn 30. And if the insurance companies screen out people, they won't give insurance to the people who have that gene. Well, that's bad because then they have to bear that risk by themselves. Now, there are various ways you can get around this. In theory, you might have mandate insurance, so you have to insure everybody. And indeed, if you look at the way we provide health insurance, typically health insurance will be provided to all employees of an organization, and you don't get this kind of adverse selection. And if you're only allowed to change your health insurance once a year. At Berkeley, we're in the middle of our open enrollment months, so people can make changes. Otherwise, as soon as you became pregnant or as soon as you discovered you had some disease, you might go for the best insurance. So you get this adverse selection problem with the people who are most in need of insurance aren't necessarily able to buy it. So up until now, I've been talking a lot about just private incentives, but there's also a kind of social issue here. That it's possible to conceive of situations, at least, where the private market wouldn't necessarily solve the cybersecurity problem, because only the groups that were most likely to be attacked would want to buy the insurance, and the insurance might end up being so costly that the bulk of the people who might be interested in purchasing it couldn't afford it. So you get this adverse selection that can happen in insurance markets. It's not quite as rosy as the picture I painted before. You may need to have some kind of mandated rules. So, for example, insurance companies are not allowed to condition their policy on certain factors. Okay? And there's a big debate, as you all know, about this genetic testing issue, whether that could be a component of issuing life insurance policies. There's a good argument why you might want to regulate or have certain requirements in that environment. So let's think about now, step back and think more about infrastructure protection, not just the private insurance market with private attacks, but something that could have much broader social consequences. And economists talk about private goods versus public goods. With a private good, it's excludable. If I eat this ice cream cone, then you can't eat it. And it's rival in the sense that, well, there's a certain amount of ice cream out there, and the more I take for myself, the less you have. So that's a typical good. We're all familiar with private goods. But then there are goods that are public goods, so things like streetlights. I can't exclude you from using the services of the streetlight, and it's also not rival. The fact that you get to use the service of the streetlight doesn't have any impact on my use of the service of the streetlight. Unless you're so big that I'm standing in your shadow. So you think about it, in lots of kinds of security, lots of goods are really public goods in the security area, things like national defense. So if you country invests more in national defense, then it's not excludable. You have the same protections that I do. And if it's not rival, because the fact that there's more invested in national defense doesn't mean that I'm any less secure. There's a cost to that. We all have to pay more taxes if we invest more in national defense. But it doesn't have these characteristics of private goods. And so you need to think about those kinds of infrastructure protection issue as having a public good component. And do you want to do it an individual choice or as a social choice? So here's my graphic to illustrate this. If you want to have a gated community where there's one big fence around everybody, or do you want to have each person build a fence for themselves? So you think about national defense. Well, we could all hire mercenaries, and then we'd all have our own little private armies, or we could all contribute towards the national defense that provides services to the entire community. So if you think about a lot of these cybersecurity things, they might have that characteristic, and what are the considerations that you'd want to look at when you're trying to decide, well, this should be determined privately, maybe by liability, maybe by insurance companies, and this kind of thing should be determined publicly. Well, one thing you want to think about is production costs. Is there an economy of scale and protection? If you go back to the housing example, you might well argue it's cheaper to build one big fence than to build all these little fences around every house. And it might well be that you want to put your money, you get more bang for the buck out of putting your money into infrastructure protection than you do in putting it in having each individual or each organization have its own private security. But also you want to look about this issue of decision costs. It may be that making social decisions is very complicated and messy. We all have to vote on it, or there's, you know, congressmen, and there's all sorts of things, regulation, all sorts of stuff that go into those social decisions. Private decisions, everybody can decide for themselves how much security they want. There's coordination and complexity in management costs, so even once the decision is made that we want to have some level of infrastructure protection, and you still have to actually implement it, and that can be very costly, as we know, looking at the Department of Homeland Security. There's the effectiveness of the measures, there's a clarity about who's responsible, because the issue is if the security decision is a private decision, and each organization decides how much they want to invest in hardening their systems or instituting risk management for their systems, then it's quite clear that who bears the cost if the systems fail. Whereas if you have some vague assignment of liability over who bears the cost, then it can be much more difficult to implement. And finally, I think there's a very important argument of genetic diversity, in the sense that if there's a one-size-fit-all solution, you haven't really explored the whole space of what might work. And if you have a bunch of different organizations implementing somewhat different systems, then you can explore what kinds of systems could be most effective in risk management. So I'm not going to end up with an answer saying, well, the bottom line is X. It's really more a case of saying these are the sorts of concerns that you need to look at when you're trying to decide whether you should emphasize private security or a kind of social system. So let me say a word or two about weakest link. So earlier I talked about public goods, and when you think about security, in some cases at least, as a public good, as an infrastructure security, what you might think about is you might think about three different models, just as an organization, as a way of thinking about it. Obviously there's a lot of gray cases. You might think that the total security of the system depends on the maximum effort that's put in by the various parties. You might think it depends on the sum of the effort, or you might think it depends on the minimum effort. So go back to my story about a wall. What might matter is you might have two walls around your castle, and what matters from the viewpoint of security is which one's the highest, right? That's the maximum of the preventive measures. You might look at the height of the wall. There's one wall, but it's different heights, and then it depends on the the total amount of effort, the total amount of construction costs that go into building that wall. Or maybe it depends on the height of the wall at the lowest point, which is kind of the minimum of the preventive measures. So, in general, you could have total effort, you could have sum of effort, you could have the weakest link. And if you look at security systems, in some cases, each of these would be plausible models for how a component of the system influences the probability of the cost of the bad event occurring. And particularly, security people always say, well, security is typically characterized by this weakest link technology. So you think about the weakest link technology, if you want to make the system stronger, you have to increase everything, right? Or you have to increase the weakest link to do it. And then if some other link becomes weakest, you have to increase that. So what you need to do, essentially, is the cost of the system becomes quite high if you have to strengthen every weakest link across the board. And private incentives are not bad in that case if the party who is the weakest link bears the cost of the incursion, but they can be very, very bad if the party who's the weakest link doesn't bear the cost of the incursion, because obviously they have a they have an incentive to slack off. So with that kind of technology, it's very, very important to coordinate the effort of the parties that contribute to the security. So I mentioned again this this Ross Anderson paper, which I recommend, on why crypto systems fail. And the answer to the question, maybe I'm giving away the punchline, but the answer to the question is mostly it's because of human failure, because of failures and incentives. And so what do you do to try to make these systems more effective? The first thing is to get the incentives right. And you can do that by looking at the liability rules. You can do that by getting professional risk management in there, whether it's in the form of insurance companies or in the form of just hired consultants. You can also get in outside monitors and auditors, such as the insurance company, who's in an objective position to try to manage the risk. Because after all, if these risks are relatively rare events, it's going to be important to try to aggregate the experience across many different occurrences of the event. And no individual organization is going to be in a good position to do that. It has to be a grouping of organizations. Somehow that's what the insurance industry is all about. You want to try to follow standardized procedures and have those procedures determined, again, as part of the insurance rules or the liability rules. And you probably want something like this due care standard that if you meet the required conditions in terms of your operations, then you're off the hook with respect to liability, or the insurance company will pay you in the case that the bad event actually does occur. And finally, you want to think about how organizations, large organizations, whether they're Walmart or the Pentagon or the federal government, what kind of role they play in terms of setting the standards that the insurance companies or the liability system might actually implement. And indeed, when you go back and look at the history of new technology, like aviation is a nice example, then it was quite clear that the federal government, particularly the military and then some regulatory boards, set the standards for aviation safety, and if you met the standards for aviation safety, then in fact the insurance industry could function once those standards were well defined and people could estimate the actuarial probabilities of the event occurring. So I don't know that computer security is so hugely different than other kinds of new technology that have brought new risks. It's just that the computer security is really at a very early stage of its evolution, and my guess is that you'll follow some of the same patterns that we've seen in other industries. So that's about all I had to say, and I'd be happy to take any questions or comments.
I have a question.
Okay.
Sometimes neither the grandmother in Florida nor Microsoft really loses the most, but say if the grandmother's computer is a bot in a botnet, the third party that is attacked, Yahoo.com, say, is the one that actually loses the most. So who should pay for insurance in this case?
Okay. So this is a, if I understand the question might be, a case might be something like this. You've got the party writes some software, say an operating system. User installs the software. Some third party uses a zombie to take that over and attacks a fourth party. So we have four parties. You've got whoever creates the system, whoever uses the system. You've got the attacker who takes over the system, doesn't impose any costs on grandma, doesn't impose any costs on the party that creates the system, but they do impose costs on a fourth party who's attacked because of the zombie on this computer. Is that the framework?
Yes.
Okay. So then you have to go through the kind of analysis I said earlier. The cost is borne over here. We want to assign some cost to these two parties, grandma and the operating system maker, that will have them undertake appropriate actions to avoid this poor sucker from being attacked, right? So, by the way, it may be there are yet other parties. There's the network provider who provides the network to which grandma's system connects to, and My guess in that particular case is the network provider might be the party that's best positioned to try to reduce the cost that the fourth party receives over here. And the operating system maker has, you would think, some responsibility, but I would guess that grandma really doesn't have much responsibility at all in that case. Because, I mean, when I say responsibility, I don't mean that as a moral view, I just mean that as there isn't much she can do to really stop this zombie from attacking her system. What you would think is the network provider might bear a certain amount of the liability, and the manufacturer of the software might bear some of the liability. Because it doesn't matter who pays the cost. I mean, it doesn't matter who bears the cost. There's some cost to this incursion or this incident or this accident. And there are various parties that are in a position to influence that. And we want to look at the actions that they can take to reduce the expected cost of that event occurring. That's my argument.
Anybody else here? No? Hey, San Diego, questions?
All right, let's thank
you. Okay, thank you.